All right, good evening. It is the Thursday Night Special. I'm Keith Washburn, and joining me tonight, I've got, we're going to talk about white nationalism, believe it or not. That's our topic. And to talk about that tonight, I've got Pastor Greg Ely with Colonial Presbyterian Church, and also Pastor Dennis Solis with Crosspoint Community Church. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming. I know these guys very well. We've done, I would call it community action together.
That's right.
Right? I consider both these gentlemen good friends.
Yeah.
And you guys are both aware that I did an interview with a white nationalist. He made a point of saying he's not a white supremacist. He thinks that's a term that's used by the media, but he considers himself a white nationalist. And it was about a half hour. Well, we got it down to a half hour, and we aired that earlier this year. So we're going to play some of that tonight and just talk about just kind of a rebuttal. Talk about, you know, what makes sense about this. How does somebody get a viewpoint like this, et cetera, et cetera. So let me play our first segment here. And we may have to use the headphones, but we'll try this for a second. Let's start it up here. Why did you join in the beginning? I mean, you were interested in World War II, but not everybody that's interested in war history joins a white nationalist group. Why did you join?
Well, that's true. I mean, I just joined it because I thought the political ideology of it was correct. I mean, you know, most people have their beliefs. Like, I researched multiple things before I started doing anything like that or researching anything more than into that. So I thought it was proper. I thought it was correct. I thought everything was right. And that's what I followed upon through my incarceration and through everything in my life. That's what I, you know, started my white nationalist stuff with.
All right, that's the first clip. And, you know, you guys have heard this in its entirety, but, you know, just comment starting off with what he said there.
You know, well, first of all, Keith, I want to say thank you for inviting us on the show and, you know, for you taking that step and just having this conversation, being brave enough to push into uncomfortable territory. I don't know what the pushback was after you had the nationalist on, but I'm sure that it was a fun ride of email and text messages. But I know me and Dennis and myself have been working with you in this area, and we've encountered these things before. But you know, when I hear him talk, you know, one of the first things he said was that he joined because he thought it was correct, you know. And, you know, if I was to be able to sit down with him, I would have to question what did he mean by correct and what is he comparing it to. And he says, I know it was the right way, you know. And I guess that depends on your perspective and your viewpoint.
to say whether
something's correct or not, you know. But in that regard, I think, you know, just even starting off the back, you kind of hear the mindset of a one way thinking person, that, you know, for these type of people that I've run into and I've had conversations, that no matter how much pushback or how much a rationalizing or communication you have with that person, you're never going to get them to change what they have stuck their stake in the ground for.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the issue of isolation and nurturing. You know, if someone's been isolated and here's one point of view, and that's nurtured in them, they just tend to accept it as the truth. It feels familiar and comfortable. And you know, it's that old saying that we often throw around in our circles, is that we don't know what we don't know, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think James, I think his name was, right? James, you know, reminds me of a person who's been nurtured and isolated and therefore doesn't know what he doesn't know. And we all have that. And the way you work through that is to talk to people that are different and think differently and process that. So,
yeah, we have a little group that met actually right before this. And there's a gentleman in there named Leon Dixon. And he said, you know, they've actually had situations where people, once they got to know an African-American, we can just see how it would happen, right? It's like, oh, wait a minute, the light goes on. So this gentleman, as you say, just may be very isolated. Let's listen to just a little bit more.
Well, I just went before, there's another thing that Dennis said that kind of, kind of sparked my thinking. When he says it's comfortable, in reality is when he says it was correct, what he's saying is comfortable. It's what I'm used to. It's what I've been around. It's how I've engaged. It's what's influenced my upbringing. When I saw this and when I heard this way of thinking, it made me feel home again.
All right, let's listen just a little bit more here. So would you say, during your childhood, your upbringing, if you want to say anything about, where you grew up and just your general beliefs that you were taught from your parents and so forth, do you think that you always had a prejudicial view of people of color and also Jewish people?
Oh, yeah, people of color, of course, because I went to school with only 19 people in my senior class. A very small town. I grew up out in the country, in the wood, basically, not in the suburb area, not in the city. I'm from the rural area, out in the country. So it was all white schools and just how my upbringing was.
So you're graduating class of 19, all white people.
Yes, sir.
Was it at that point that you were prejudiced against people of color, or literally that you just didn't know anybody who was, a black person or any other person of color?
Well, it would probably be because I didn't know no one like that.
Why do you... All right, so a little bit more there.
I don't know if this is the right word, but when we talk about racism in our society, we often think of the victims being minorities. But the truth is, everyone's affected by it and hurt by it. And so I see a scenario in which someone inherited isolation again, and that's really hindered his ability to see beyond that. So I see James as someone who unfortunately was given a scenario and a context that didn't help him see the bigger world and understand things. And so, the whole idea of inheriting, I often suggest that all of us have to look at America in 2018 and recognize that we've inherited a lot of baggage from our racist past. And until we understand it, we're going to kind of just let it exist. Mm-hmm. We're going to let the lines, the dividing lines exist, the residential and even in our churches, exist. And until we recognize this is a part of our inheritance as Americans due to our past, we really can't address it very well. But so,
yeah. It's interesting. You say I went to school, in the country, graduating from a class of only 19. And of course, and he talked about how his environment was all white, and how he never really had to engage with a black person. But somehow, having not engaged with a black person when he did come into contact with a black person, something happened. There was something about their interaction that fueled what he already thought. You graduated a class of 19 in the countryside, and the reality is, I think he talks about how he was only, 37 years old. He graduated from high school, say 17, so what, that's 20 years ago? So that's 1998. That's not that far ago, where you are in a society, we try to make this conversation like racism is over or it doesn't exist, you know. And I know that, you know, there's discussions today about, you know, we use the term racism, but racism is a term that we so socially use to be able to describe the difference between each other. But whatever you want to, however you want to describe it, the discrimination between one group of people and another group of people is what he's talking about. And that reality is right up against us in history. It's not like something that we celebrate that we've killed in 1964, you know, or the post civil rights movement. You know, we're all done with that. But that is a reality that in 1998, and believe this or not, Keith, that first time I saw white people in church, I was 15, probably 14, 15 years old, you know. And because I grew up in the urban core of Austin, Texas, interacted with all black people on a regular basis. I went to school, was bused to all white neighborhoods, so I saw white teachers and white people there, but really wasn't engaged in the Christian community from a white perspective until my dad went to seminary at Austin Theological Seminary and went to an event that they had at one of the churches. And I remember looking around saying, man, these white people, they say Jesus too, you know, and they wave their hands and they're clapping. And that was something strange to me. But having engaged with mostly a black environment, then having come in contact with white people didn't all of a sudden fuel something in me to hate them. You know what I mean? And there was common communication in my neighborhood. I had uncles that say I can't trust white people. I had my father who, you know, who struggled with that area because of things that had happened to him. But when I came in contact with white people, there was something inside of me that said, you know what? What the message I am hearing is not matching to the person that I'm talking to. So something I'm saying possibly initiated his first encounters with black people were something that caused a disruption in his mind. Then moving forward, this is what black people are like, you know.
Yeah, and whatever preconceived notions he had that he was told by other white people right there in his town. Yeah, that would totally prejudice your thought process the first time you did meet a black person, right?
Right.
There, I may not have met my mark here. Let's see if we can listen to a little more.
Do you think most people join? If you could say one reason why most people join.
Well, most people in society will say, oh, they join out of fear, or they join out of protection, or they just want attention. But most people join because they see the popular culture and the ruling class activity, working class, against their interest through the things they bring to the media and not white immigration policy. So they join because, like I join because of my political belief, because I see what the media is doing. I see what, you know, people are doing. So I thought, you know, so nationalism was what I wanted to be.
What's interesting is that he kind of talks about this as if it's a political, like I belong to the Republican Party or I belong to the Democratic Party, as opposed to, you know, thinking of it as, no, this is actually, you know, being against a class of people here, a whole, you know, people of color and, of course, Jewish people, too. Mm-hmm. So, thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was interesting because I think it's the very opposite. He said it's not about fear.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's the very opposite. You know, everything that's happening in America right now, or a lot of it, the past election that we had and so on, there are elements of fear. And that's pretty obvious that's the case. There are elements of fear happening. You know, when white people hear that by the year 2045, that's the latest projection that whites will be a minority in America, 49%, and minorities will now make up the majority collectively. When he says later about making America great again, what he's talking about is preserving. He said it is about the very things he said it's not about. It's preserving what he perceives to be white culture. Because there's fear that it's being taken away. Now the media becomes kind of the, you know, the
catalyst.
Yeah, catalyst for that. But that's exactly what it's about. That's exactly what it's about.
Yeah, he says it's not about fear. You know, some people may join for fear, but it's not about fear. But you see what people out there are doing. So it's like, you know, you say it's not about fear, then you proceed to describe the reason why you're doing it is because you see what people are doing. You are afraid of what you see in the news, in the media, whatever the case may be, and it has caused you, which pushes me back to his initial statement about being incarcerated, you know, and we may touch on that another piece, but when he says that when I engage in through my incarceration, I encountered or started engaging and talking with black people, and I can imagine that not being a safe environment for him, which eventually probably led to a fearful decision to choose what he thought was self-preservation and joining in with the group.
Very, very, very much could have been that, yeah. Well, let's listen a little bit more.
One of the things that you personally believe is that we should just be segregated. White folks should live with white folks, black folks should live with black folks, and so forth.
Well, I think we should all be able to be separated if we wanted to be. I feel like right now, if you look now at society, black folks live in the wards. They live in the projects. You do have your upper class of people, but we're still segregated out here on the streets. I still think that I feel comfortable around my own or my own people versus a bunch of other races that I don't know anything about. I don't agree with their beliefs or their structures or anything like that.
All right. So, yeah, my question to him about, you know, are you a separatist? I didn't say it just that way, but obviously he believes in his own, right? His own. He's claiming people like him. You know, I mean, it's like the Hutus and the Tutsis or whatever, right? You know, those people are so different. Well, they still have black skin. No, but they're so different than I am.
Yeah. In reality, you know, separatism is something that finds itself racially and within race, as you just said, the Wusus and the Tutsis. You find that happen in the black culture, even with light skin and dark skin. You find that happen in the white culture with white collar and blue collar. You know, we keep with our own, we stay with our own. You know, it is a matter of a sinful mindset that makes you feel like that you have to keep with a certain group of people, otherwise you lose identity. You know, I've seen it, you know, in knowing lower class white people whose parents told them, don't go approach an uppity white girl. You know, I mean, I've seen that from friends of mine who's had that conversation. I've seen that happen, you know, interracially, you know, to try to keep our own. It boils back down to a mindset of being comfortable of the fear that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a matter of fact, he said that again. He says, I'm comfortable with my own, you know. And, you know, my question would be to him, you know, why? Why are you so much comfortable with your own? Have you not been threatened by your own people? Have you not been harmed by your own people? You know, because I have. You know, and I think all of us have to admit that.
You've been harmed
by other
African-Americans.
My own people.
Right,
you know
absolutely.
What I mean? So I can't use the sense of fear to generalize a whole group of people.
Yeah. You know, I just think that white nationalism or, you know, supremacy, it's when you see it in the context of America, of the United States, you just see the very what I would call the very poor logic of the ideology of white nationalism and how it's in a lot of ways it's just a screen for white supremacy, white privilege, and all those things, and it's just kind of repackaged, you know, and so it's taken the edge off of it by saying it's not against you, it's just for me. But America can't survive in that mentality. That's the problem, right? We're not going to survive if everybody's just for themselves,
right,
and not for anybody else.
Yeah.
And that's culturally as well as racially, you know. And so it's, to me, it's really obvious what he's projecting is just it's really just more of the same,
right?
when it comes to our legacy.
Yeah.
As Americans, it's more of the same.
And it's scary that he would place his views of white nationalists into a political party, you know, as to say, this is just the way I vote. Like, the color of a person's skin and their background determines who I vote for. You know, that my I like their political views. Well, the political views are that Jews and black people and people of color are lower than I am. That's not a political view, and that's a personal view of a person from the outward mindset. You know, so.
Yeah, before we play the next segment, I want to say, first of all, you're listening to KKFI, and my guests are Dennis Solis, Pastor Dennis Solis, and Pastor Greg Ely, both local ministers here in town, both of whom are good friends of mine, and we're listening to a clip that I did of a white nationalist interview, and some of you might be wondering, why did you ever do an interview with a white nationalist? The way it happened was I was affiliated with a guy from ABC News, and he was doing a story here in Kansas City, and he called me up one day and said, "Keith, I need you to find me a white nationalist." Well, I was like, "What? I mean, where do
Hold
you
on, let me check my Rolodex.
Exactly. Should I look under S for supremacist, or what do you think?" But I eventually did find James. Unfortunately, I couldn't find anybody here in Kansas City, but I got to say, there are probably plenty of white nationalists here in, you know, the Kansas City area, I would guess.
I live around a corner from a couple.
All right, let's listen to a little bit more of James.
So you didn't mention African Americans. Are they one of the main groups that you don't like, or are they just sort of, well, it's a person of color that I just don't really want to hang around with?
Well, yeah, because, you know, their beliefs, their structures, their everything's different than we are. They all say we're all the same, but we're not. It's like the Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. Like, I, you know, out here, they don't do nothing. They just rob. They've got drugs and guns. I mean, that's something we don't do. So I believe that they're against it. They totally hate the white man. Hate this. You can see that online on videos, to where they're talking about killing the white man. Oh, they just the things that we're not about to tell them that.
So in some ways, the anger has been escalated by the fact that there are African Americans who seem angry, who seem to me making mm-hmm. white people as targets. Is that what you would say?
Oh yes, you can see it on the news. That is correct. Yes.
So you notice he said, we don't do that. He talked about drug use, and he said, we don't do that. Well, I don't know. Are there any white people that are using drugs? And you know,
well, I'll tell you this. Like an old friend of mine said, you know, in the 80s, it wasn't very many black people that had airplanes and boats to get stuff shipped into the community. So to try to make it seem like that somehow we invented drugs and guns without having the capacity to even get it into the inner city is to be confused at where the drugs and the guns came from. So
yeah, you just hear him living off the stereotypes, right?
He's just
bouncing right off of that and feeding it the stereotypes, you know. Going to prison, which is a rough environment, and then basing your view partly on a whole group of people in prison. Come on,
yeah. Unhealthy. Well, you know, in the prison system, I haven't been to prison myself, but I have friends and I have family members who are in prison, you know, and you talk to them about the survival mentality that mm-hmm. they have, and you quickly link up with a group of people that you closely identify with for safety matters. Mm-hmm. And most times for black people, that ends up being the Muslim community, which grows large in the prison system because they link up together. And for the white, side is usually white supremacists or skinheads, you know, and those kind of groups that they link up with for protection. So him going to prison and him developing this mindset of black people is what he saw. You know, he saw predominantly the stereotypes, you know, people who may have been in prison because of drugs, people who may be in prison because of guns. But for him to have an encounter with a black person and to determine that whole race is about, because he says their beliefs, their structure. So he generalizes a whole race from an encounter he had or some video that he saw. For him to take that instance and generalize a whole ethnicity of being of drug dealers and killers would be like me leaving from this interview hearing him thinking all white people are white supremacists.
great point.
Yeah. And yeah. I know that they're not because I like you.
Yeah. I hate to call him, you know, the I word, but it's ignorance, yeah. Meaning, you know, he just doesn't know. He's oblivious to any other point of view. And here's something that's true of all human beings. We usually gather evidence for what we believe, yes. Right? We're looking for things to confirm what we already believe. Right. So I think he went into prison already with this distorted view.
Yeah. Right.
And then once in prison, you know, as you said, he may have, you know.
Magnified example. It just exacerbated. It made it even huge. All of his thoughts of what he saw, you know, because in 1998, it was the height of gangster rap, you know. It was the polarizing figure of that time. You know, I remember I was in high school I was in college by that time, you know, and in 98. And it was this, you know, polarizing new form of entertainment that began to flood and create the stereotype. And on that side, when I'm talking to young black men, you know, I tell them that you can't be upset with someone who treats you like a stereotype when you act like the stereotype. You know, so if you glorifying walking around with 40 ounces and holding guns in your hand and your pants are sagging down, don't get mad when somebody locks their door when you walk by. Shoot, I'm gonna lock my door when you walk by. If you walking around, you know, looking like that. And so part of it on our side is that we have to stop glorifying a gangster mentality and culture and then being upset with people because they generalize us to fit into that category.
That's a fair point. I do want to remind our listeners, coming up next is the Thursday Night Local Showcase. And tonight, I'll be hosting Millage Gilbert, Kansas City blues legend. He is in the other room, and these guys both just met him. Yeah, Millage is turning 80 this year, so stay tuned for that at 8 o'clock. Let's play a little bit more of my interview with James.
Like, we survived Harvey here in the Texas area. They didn't do nothing. We did it for everyone, you know. We helped them. They've never, and they're always talking about screaming, kill the white man, do all this, do all that, which, you know, which makes kind of a starting war we have towards them.
So in some ways, it sounds like you feel like the war really was started by other than the white nationalists. Would that be a fair statement?
We didn't start the war. We're just standing up for what is right for ours.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he noticed, and I want to push into this just a little bit, and we said this at the top of the show. I mean, the three of us, Dennis, Greg, and myself, are all going to be on the same side of the table on something that involves a racial issue.
Right.
But I want to at least take a devil's advocate viewpoint here, yeah, and let's push into this idea that he has that somehow he and the rest of the white people are doing all the work, but they didn't do any of the work after the hurricane hit. They were sitting around, you know, yelling at us or whatever he says they were doing.
Well, for me specifically, my brother was in Hurricane Harvey in Houston when it happened. And I know specifically that he was one of the people who were helping and actually used his own personal truck to get out and help people get into safety. So to try to take this general statement that we were the ones that were helping, you know, you see what you want to see, you know. And on the other side of it, you know, if I could afford a boat, I would help. Mm-hmm. You know, in a lot of situations, you know, where a lot of the damage happened, you had those people who want to help but can't. So to say that we were the only ones that were doing anything is a lie, you know, in itself. I know a number of other people and other stories. Matter of fact, one was advertised on Good Morning America, a black man who used his boat to get out there and pull people in. He was just going back in, and he hadn't slept in like 24 hours, but he was still out there helping, you know. And so I think it's another opportunity to try to take a scenario and make it into something evil when it's really not enough there for you to have any material evidence to try to prove your point.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, what do you do with that kind of absolute statement? You know, it's way over
right.
the top.
Right.
You know,
when
Katrina happened, you know, there was a group from our church that went. It was a mixed group. Mm. It was black and whites who went together to serve and help as much as we could. And So, you know, I mean, where does that kind of absolute language and statement, where does it get us? You
well, know? No, specifically the National Baptist Convention, which is all predominantly black church Baptist convention, mm-hmm. Had a team formed and sent whole groups mm-hmm. of black churches, yeah. People in predominantly black churches, down there to do work in the neighborhoods. I know Ed Harvey, we had people here in Kansas City that sent donations and sent people down right. to go help. Right. So, right. yeah, I'm just.
You know, so he's, like just, he's just, again, he's just promoting the stereotypes across the board.
Yeah, and as yeah. Greg says, you know, you see what you want to see.
Right.
Yeah, actually, and then
right.
he says, you know, we didn't start the war. You know, we didn't start the war. We're just trying to hold our ground. Well, I didn't start Jim Crow. mm-hmm. You know, I didn't put my people right. in slavery. You know, I didn't come uproot a group of people who were fine and bring them to a place where they didn't want to come. So at some point, somebody else started the war, but you can't put that on me.
mm. So which is worst? For your group, Jews, Jewish people, or black people?
Well, to me personally, the Jews are the media. The media portrays on TV for everyone, all your Americans, all the citizens to watch it. They can make you think whatever you want to think through that news. The banks and the Black Lives Matter, they're on the streets causing ruckus, causing hell, causing all these things, even if a job's not in it. They're just, and then they, you know, they always relapse on what happened hundreds of years ago and stuff like that. So they're kind of, to me, I mean, this is me speaking. For me, they're both equal, if not worse. I mean, they just, they're both against the white man is what it is, and that's all it is.
Well,
not saying all African-Americans, I'm not saying all Jewish people, but I'm saying majority of it attacking us.
Well, and there could be, I'm sure that there are plenty of Jewish people who consider themselves white. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, yes, sir.
All right, so let's pick that apart a little bit. He said a lot of things about Jewish people. He really didn't come out that strongly against African Americans. Right. His comment about the hurricane cleanup was about it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, he did. Yeah. You know, say that all about drugs and guns.
Oh, right,
just
right.
Want to shoot
oh, you're
kill
right.
People.
At the end of the day, he was in the same place with yeah. African Americans yeah. as with Jews.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more.
His strongest
yeah.
comments were about Jewish people.
Yeah. The comments that came without you asking the questions were about Jews. When you asked the questions about Jews or blacks, then he went in on black people, which lets us know that his mindset is there, but you know his thought process about Jews is also actually more scary to me than they are about blacks. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think he goes on to say that they're the scum of the earth.
He says they're parasites.
Mm-hmm. Parasites.
Yeah, right.
He said the Jews are parasites, and to describe a group of people as parasites is definitely a Nazi mindset. You know what I mean? It's you know, the Holocaust.
Right.
I mean, it's back in
there'll
that
be,
point.
No empathy, no compassion,
yeah.
no relatability
right.
to a whole group of people. Where does that lead you when he talks about no violence?
Mm.
Where does that ultimately lead you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I mean, just to be in a place, you know, and I guess it goes back to a heart of hatred, you know. To be in a place where you can look at a group of people and call them parasites. You know, to say a parasite is to indicate that I haven't had a conversation with you. It's not that I know what your background is or what degrees you have or what your personality is. It is simply because of your bloodline, you deserve to be wiped out. And that's a sick mindset.
And then to say that again in the context of relevantly contemporary history.
Yeah.
The Holocaust.
Yeah.
And to be able to say that, you know.
You're asking for violence, mm-hmm. you know. He asked for violence. You know, we don't. We're not about violence. We're not about that. You know, you guys are about drugs and guns and shooting and kill a white person. When you call a group of people a parasite, I'm thinking you're going to kind of raise up some violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to tell our listeners because I see a lot of people trying to call in. We just don't have anybody to answer the phones tonight, so we're not going to be able to take your calls. I apologize for that. But I do also want to just pause here. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, and we're going to play a couple of announcements, and we'll be right back. Thursday night local showcase coming your way with Kansas City Blues legend Millage Gilbert. He's turning 80 this year, and we'll have him in studio to talk about the Grand Emporium and much more. That's this week. Our Blues team will be playing Millage Gilbert and a whole lot of other blues artists this Thursday night from 8 to 10 right here on 90.1 FM KKFI. He has been extremely respectful, and what you're saying is you will afford that same respect to other people in the workplace and other people that you are, in a way, forced to be around. It's just you don't want to hang out with them.
Would I live with them? Would I live with them? Would I eat with them? Would I stay with them? No. No, not at all. But, okay. Yeah, unfortunately, I have to work. I have to have a job, you know, so I have to work around them people. And as long as I get respect from the people, that they're going to get right back to me.
Okay, so that's one of my favorite things to pick on is when people talk about those people. Yeah, or in this case, he said them people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and this is something that is, you know, it is not just on race, right? What do we do? It's like, well, those people are so much different than I am.
Alienation, isolation.
Whereas what Pastor Ely said earlier, which is, have a conversation. You know, if you're afraid of somebody, unless you think they're going to physically harm you, but if you're afraid of somebody, strike up a conversation with them. See if you can actually, you know, find out what they're about. There's probably something you got in common with them.
Right.
Well, what he says, I can't, would I live with them? Would I eat with them? Would I talk to them? No. But I got a job, so I respect them, you know, and I have to respect them. I have professional relationships with them. And to me, you just contradicted yourself, you know, because you have to live with them, you have to work with them, you have to walk alongside them at work. So if they are good enough for you to work next to, then why are they not good enough for you to live next to? Mm-hmm. You know, because the same person that you said, as long as he shows you respect, I'll show him respect at work, then the same principle should apply if he lives next door to you. The same principle should apply when you engage with him. As long as they respect, he respects me and I respect him, then we can have a relationship together.
Yeah. I think the other thing is, again, just to emphasize it again, I it's a short walk from that attitude of them and so on and so forth to completely dehumanizing people. And then that leads to other things. And, you know, so that's a serious matter.
You definitely have to be careful walking down that trail, because you end up on that slope of demoralizing the whole race.
Yeah, you know, in preparation for this show, I called Pastor Cassandra Wainwright, and we talked a little bit. And I said, I don't think this particular guy, I mean, truly, I don't. I cannot know if this guy is dangerous, but I don't think he's dangerous. Is his rhetoric dangerous? Well, yes. And what you just said, Dennis, and Pastor Ely, is that, you know, when you get, let's say now, 8 guys having breakfast with this kind of talk, yeah, right? It only takes one guy who's a little bit, you know, out there to be sitting there thinking like, oh, somebody's got to do something about this. And that's the person that goes out and gets a gun and shoots somebody.
Right. Well, like you just said, you know, it's not, you know, if you listening to this person, of course, we don't, you know, we can't judge whether or not, you know, he would actually take the next steps of being violent. But I don't hear that in his voice. I hear, like you said earlier, you know, use the term ignorance. I hear ignorance. I hear someone who's angry, who probably had a bad experience with black people. And obviously, you know, with Jews, I can't tell if he had a bad experience or he was just raised to hate Jews, because all I hear him saying about Jews is not about interaction, but what they provide in the media. So he, from what I can hear, he hasn't had any real interaction with Jews, but he's had interaction with black people, and it's causing this rhetoric. But rhetoric is fuel. Mm-hmm. Rhetoric is, like you said, it is that person who is probably just on the fence of being angry about a group of people, but then someone comes in and continues to talk about it, to you get fuel to the sense where you have to take action, because my people are in question. My way of life is being jeopardized. So that means I need to take action, and then the rhetoric turns into violence.
Right. And so part of it, too, is, you know, the whole – so a concern is kind of the political climate we've been in, and how guys like James have felt empowered to speak more and speak more boldly. You know, that's an issue, you know, and like you said, it goes from a spark to a bonfire, you know, and that's what happens because of the power of words and what they can lead to.
And I want to say, you know, and make this point that we're commenting about James and his views of white nationalism and the rhetoric that fuels of talking about blacks and Jews. But on the same side, you know, there are blacks and people of color who use rhetoric that fuels hate toward white people. I'm saying it's all wrong. You know, I'm not trying to say that, you know, we're sitting here as black, myself black, and Dennis as Hispanic pastor, and saying, oh, this white person is evil because he has this evil rhetoric. We're saying the rhetoric is wrong, whoever it comes from, whether that's a white supremacist or whether that's a pro-black, I hate white people person, whoever the case may be. When you fuel that type of fire, you increase a level of an environment's ability to explode from hatred.
Yeah, and I do want to tell our listeners again who my guests are. It's Pastor Greg Ely with Colonial Presbyterian Church, formerly with Paseo Baptist, and Pastor Dennis Solis with Cross Point Community Church. And Dennis, you've got, just briefly, I want to tell the folks that you have quite a mixed congregation. You're over there on Hillcrest, down by the Grandview Triangle,
yeah,
right?
Right. We're a primarily African-American and white congregation. Have some of the best people in Kansas City. I look up to them because of how they have willfully and come together. And even though, you know, culture is a real thing,
yes,
right?
It is.
And yet, so many of our people have been willing to get to know people that are of a different culture, and have been willing to set aside some preferences when it comes to culture, even maybe even church, and because they want to get to know each other and want to love each other and want to work together for the kingdom of God. And so all the folk at Cross Point are my heroes, really.
So we'll say a shout out to Cross Point congregation and also Pastor Ely's congregation at Colonial Presbyterian. So let's hear some more of James.
Oh, I'm a very godly man. I'm a Christian. I'm a very Christian man.
Okay. One thing that, and you know, I'm not trying to trick you up here. Just take your time and listen to this and see if you can see kind of where I'm going with this, is that in the Bible, of course, it describes Adam and Eve, you know, those sorts of things, the Garden of Eden. So if it started, which it seems like at some point it would have had to start with just two people, but if it started with just two people, then wouldn't we all be part of the same family in some ways?
Well, you would think that's true, and they say Adam and Eve did start in the garden, but who really knows? I don't want to say that you can look at my bloodline and I go back to Africa or nothing like that. No, that's not true. I could trace mine. I mean, so I can't say that. I mean, I believe that, you know, it started somewhere, but we actually don't know where that started. I mean, I'm a very godly man, like I stated. But I think two people started it. What color were they? No, I mean, how did, you know, we don't know how this all come about.
Well, and James, and you can see, you know, just the lack of thinking it through here, right? It's like, if we're godly men, did God make these African-Americans and they're not godly men? Are, you know, Latinos not godly men and women?
Well, you know, when you say terms like that in that form, I'm a very godly man, but, you know, what you're attributing God to is a good luck charm, a belief system that is not grounded. You know, it's something that speaks to more my morality than my actually faith and my thought process. You know, because I'm a very godly man, but I don't believe the Bible. You know, I'm a very godly man, but I don't believe what the Bible says, that even though they say the Bible is the word of God, I'm a godly man, you know, and I just don't know where they came from, you know, so that's a little contradicting.
Yeah, you know, and if you take it from a theological perspective, for Christians, the Imago Dei is really important.
Yes.
It is the image of God in every man and woman. And so that is really supposed to influence our view of everyone.
Yes.
And so for us, that equalizes everybody. You know,
right.
All men and women are the children of God.
Right.
And we believe that. Maybe we're not all walking with them, but all have, I always say, they have the stamp on them, the copyright, and it's God. And another thing about, you know, I would suggest is the whole issue of race, you know. We all kind of know that race is a social, the concept of race is a social construct from about 500 years ago, came from Western Europe, and it was used basically to subjugate other groups of people in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. Those in power used it to subjugate others. Those in power used it to for colonialism, so that when you went to other countries, you could justify. And the Imago Dei was lost in all that. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of these folk were Christian folk, or part of the church anyway.
Right.
And but it was all lost. And so I you know, what is it, Greg? One drop of blood, you're black. Yeah. In the old law in the nation, America, right? Wasn't it if you had one drop?
Oh yeah, if you had one drop of blood.
You weren't white.
Yeah.
I'm not a betting man.
Yeah.
But how much you want to bet that he ain't 100% white?
Yeah, well, I don't know. You know, I don't know where I don't know where we are in the subject, but he actually makes that statement.
Yeah.
You know, in there, where he says.
Yeah, it's coming up right here.
Okay,
let's play it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let's
play it.
I was going to say, let's go to the 88 precepts and the 14 words. Can you say the 14 words?
Yes. Those 14 words are: we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children.
Okay.
That is the 14 words.
So that's the mantra.
Yeah, so, you know, the 14 words. And you can see, again, just to your guy's point, and I'm going to play another segment here, is it's a fear kind of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. I got to have a school and a place for my white children. I got to protect, right?
Yeah, that's fear. Fear and anger and hatred.
Yep. All right, let's see what else he has to say here.
The all right is a spectrum of beliefs which is foundation of his race realism and a countering the anti-white narratives of a modern public square, which is the internet. The all right is just basically a movement for us to push forward for the white race and us, because, you know, you got other movements pushing for them, so why can't we push for us?
What about the, you know, the fact that most of us are mixed in our heritage anyway? So, of course, we've got people all over the board as far as whether they are 100%, quote, white or 100%, quote, black. I'm using that in quotes. Because in some ways, it's kind of a social construct, whether you consider yourself white or black.
Well, it's like this. You got a can of white paint. If you add any color to that, that white paint's not white no more. Just plain and simple. If there's any brown, if there anything that goes in that can of white paint, any color, that paint is no longer white.
Have you done like ancestry or something like that to find out what your personal, heritage is?
No, I haven't done actual ancestry. I want to do that, but I know I have family in Europe, in Germany, in the Strassland area.
So, he's sure of his heritage, but he has not done ancestry or anything that's checked his DNA. And as Dennis said, if I were a betting man, I would be betting that it's not all white.
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, he can say, well, I don't know if everybody came from just two people. You know, it wasn't a million people. So at some point you have to believe that there is some for lack of a better term, cross-pollination that has happened in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, where we all you hear about the grandkids of Benjamin Franklin or something like that, you know, and that whole I won't even go into that. But the whole point is that there is some that I would not put my life on the line to say that I don't have white people in my lineage.
He could be banned from his own group.
Yeah.
You never know. You know.
Yeah.
Well, it's been, we got about 10 minutes left, and we have just a couple more segments to listen to, and then we'll just maybe talk a little bit to finish up the show.
Do you think that there are goals for you to accomplish? I mean, of course, you know, raising a family. I don't know if you have a family, but let's say, you know, things like that, of course, make a living. Do a good job for your workplace. Maybe you go to church on Sunday, since you said you are a committed Christian. Those sorts of things. But what would be one of your goals for this movement?
To get our people to open their eyes and realize that what we are and what we can be, don't be degraded by the media or say, oh, I'm wrong to be white or anything like that. We want to let everybody know it's okay. Let's push forward. Like, another thing, like this president's thing, there's thousands and millions of Americans that said F you and got Trump in that office for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his belief is that, you know, everybody that voted for Trump was basically on board with him. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of different people that voted for a lot of different reasons mm-hmm. for Donald Trump. That's and I even know a couple of African-Americans who told me they voted for Donald Trump.
I know a few, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, it's not everybody's voting for Trump for the same reason.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are political views that people in this past election decided were most important to them, you know, and they stuck by those. I don't, you know, I have friends of mine who voted for Trump. I had friends of mine who voted for Hillary, you know, and I'm not going to tell you who I voted for. But determining that because a person was voted in the office was the majority telling you, you know, F you, and it's time for us to take a stand and get our people back. You know, maybe that is the case. Maybe that is what it says. But I'm betting to feel that even from what we've experienced so far, that most people were not voting Trump into office so that they could get rid of black people.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I think that, and I agree with that. I think my concern would be that some of the language that's used by white nationalism resonates with folk that aren't a part of it.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Our culture is being destroyed. You know,
right.
We got to preserve our culture. I have talked with pastors, or I think of one incident, a pastor who, when we talked about the issue of the concerns of racism still in our society, he would say, and to me this sounds like in part what this gentleman was saying. He was saying, no, it's not about racism. Some people are just ethnocentric. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In other words, they're just about their own people. They just prefer their own people. This guy's saying that.
Right.
Right. He's saying that. So the only thing I would say is I think that for me as Christians, we need to be really careful about what people say and how they say it and hear their ideologies and really kind of reject stuff that can feel partly. Sometimes it can kind of make sense, but in the bigger picture, it doesn't make sense, right? You know,
right.
in the bigger context of racism in America, that's the challenge for a lot of good folk, a lot of good white folk,
mm-hmm.
is to recognize, you know, that's kind of a euphemism for something else,
yeah,
right?
Let me not use that.
Yes, mm-hmm. but bottom line is, I prefer white folk, and I think they're better than other folk.
Mm, right.
I'm not saying all whites believe that. I'm saying
sure.
The good folk need to recognize that that's a part of that.
Yeah,
yeah. I think what I also hear you saying, Pastor Solis, is that when people hear their friends using this kind of language, that it's mm-hmm. time to stop and have a conversation about it right there.
Yes,
because that's the way this stuff gets rolling.
Yes,
right. I want to talk a little bit about what Tech Sample told me. You guys know Tech Sample. He's with Moore Squared, and he's a pastor just starting over here on Armor with Trinity. He's been an interim pastor, and he's going to be their full-time leader now. I said, what would you do? How would you talk to this guy? Because the real question on my mind is, how do you talk and have a dialogue with somebody like James? Because personally, I think James is close. It may not sound on a couple of these clips like he's close, but I think he could be pulled over the line to actually an acceptance of that he's been wrong his whole life. And Tech said, you know what, I would first ask him about his family. Now, this is interesting.
Wow.
So he wants to create some conversation around his concerns for his family, because obviously he is concerned about his family.
Right.
And then maybe from there you can start talking about, the commonality that you have with a lot of African Americans, a lot of Latinos, a lot of Jewish people, is they are also, you know, concerned about their family.
Absolutely.
And you, as a working class white guy, really have quite a bit in common with working class African American people and Latinos.
Right.
You guys are all struggling to make a living.
Right.
These, you know, you guys could come together and create quite a power base.
Right.
So, yeah, Tex, yeah, I think that was pretty good.
That's great, great insight and great advice. Everybody wants to be loved and valued.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those of us who feel on the maybe on the other side of James, so to speak, we would be no different if all we had is hostility toward him, right?
Right. Exactly.
So somehow being hopeful that somehow bridges can be built.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that means you dilute the truth.
Right.
But you also have to build relationships, right?
Yeah.
And so I hear what you're saying. I mean, right. he seems like he wants to be a decent guy. He seems confused, you know?
Yeah.
And so connection with other views that are different, not a part of his really small world, could be very helpful.
Yeah, you know, like for me, you know, we mentioned earlier about Dennis's church, Cross Point, and how it's multicultural, you know, where I'm at a church now where it's predominantly white. You know, I came from a church that was predominantly black. But being in a church that's predominantly white now, I can say that for me to generalize that James represents all white people would disregard the love that I've felt since I've been in at the church that I'm at now, and how the people of Colonial have embraced me, and how I'm the pastor of this church on the Warnell campus. We have two campuses. I'm the Warnell campus, and I'm in a room with 25 older white gentlemen who are retired, and some of them are, you know, successful, and they're turning to me and they're saying, "Pastor, what should we do in the situation?" And I haven't had to earn my voice, but they honestly want to hear and know what I have to say is for me to say that they are white people who love Jesus, who are godly, and who want to be equal. Just like I know that there are black people who hate white people, who feel like they're threatened, and who may have a similar view on the other side as James does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, shouting this guy down is not going to be a solution, right? And
right.
If there was one reason to do this program, for those of you that are listening and are thinking, like, why are they even giving this guy time on the air? Well, it's because we got to, in this country, we have to figure out a way to get people together. We've got to bring the James kind of guys over, you know, with us, and right. kind of a recognition that we're all in this together. This is to make America great again means all the people in America, right?
Yes, because I live in America too, and I want it to be great, and I want that to include my 12-year-old and my 14-year-old son as well.
When I think of the church, you know, Walter Brueggemann's, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said the church is really supposed to be a community of hope.
Mm.
And so there's always got to be the belief in the possibility of change for
right.
people, right?
Absolutely.
Yep. Let's listen to just one more clip here. Well, do you think Donald Trump's, you know, his call to action was, let's make America great again. Do you think that was a call to white nationalists to say, look, let's make it, in effect, let's make it white again. Let's make it more white again.
I would like to say yes, but I can't say that for sure. You know, make America great again. We took 8 years of democracy that is pounded by Democrats. Now, he's all for everybody. He's all for the people. He's trying to bring this country up, in which he's brought up in his first year.
So, you know, there are Americans.
Interesting.
You know, the way he sees it is, you know, he's winning, so to speak. You know, again, I would just offer this, is that making a fight out of this is not going to solve anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shouting this guy down or being angry with other people and then leading, that might lead to physical violence. And then, you know, where do we go from there, right?
Right.
So
I don't think that. You know, like I said, for somebody like James, I feel sorry for him because his worldview is so limited that he's missing out on abundant life. He's missing out on the experience of knowing people who don't look like you, haven't come from your background, that opens up a door to see the beauty of humanity and what God has made.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pastor Solis?
Yeah. No, I agree. You know, I think that... you know, I think that respect is important. I do want to say that I think to build a relationship and to get to know someone is important, but it also truth is important.
Yeah.
And so there has to be the courage to speak what you think is true. And let that fall where it may. I mean, we all have our choices, right? But I think when it comes to this issue of race in America, people have to speak up and speak out. in respect, in gentleness, but speak out as well as seek to understand and know people that are different from you. It's both and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in my brief encounter with James, he was never disrespectful. He you know, was a genuinely good listener. You know, I probably talked to him for about 45 minutes, and then I did maybe 15 minutes prep even before that. So maybe I've talked to this guy an hour, okay? Mm-hmm. Always respectful. I asked him, I said, now, you and I don't have the same views on this. You realize that. I'm a lot more liberal in my views. And he said, yeah, he knew that. I said, if I was your next-door neighbor, what would that be like? And he said, we could be next-door neighbors. Mm-hmm. I'd help you do whatever you need. You need your grass cut, you know, if you hurt your back or something like that. And I believe he's telling me the truth on that. This is a guy who's, you know, who's generally, I'm going to call him, you know, a good neighbor sort of guy. Yeah. He's not going to be a good neighbor to a black person.
Yeah, I was going to say I couldn't be his neighbor, but, you know, to anybody else, he'd be a great neighbor.
Well, that does it for our show. I want to thank Pastor Greg Ely and Pastor Dennis Solis for being with
me
tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Keith.
On the Thursday night special. Coming up next, the Thursday night local showcase. And we've got Millage Gilbert for you playing lots of his music and talking about old times in Kansas City, because he's been around a long time, celebrating his 80th birthday this month. So you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.